I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today on Spark My Muse, we have Jim Davies. He's an associate professor at the Institute of Cognitive Science at Carleton University and the director of the Science of Imagination Laboratory. He's also the author of Riveted, The Science of Why Jokes Make Us Laugh, Movies Make Us Cry, and Religion Makes Us Feel One with the Universe. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure.
I was intrigued by a TED Talk that you gave, and one of the things that you do is work at the Science of Imagination Laboratory, and that is a really intriguing title for a laboratory, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about what it is that you do there and what you're working on.
Well, when I did my research for my PhD, I was studying how people solve problems by making pictures in their heads and using those pictures to help them solve problems. Mm-hmm. And every time I would talk to other scientists about what I was working on, mm-hmm. I would get asked, "So where do these visual representations come from? How do you know mm-hmm. where?" I said, "Nobody knows." So once you become a professor, you're supposed to do something related to what you did in your graduate work, but something that's your own take on it. So I said, well, that's what I'm going to tackle. I'm going to try to figure out where people get pictures in their heads. So in the laboratory, we're trying to understand visual imagination. So if you're reading a novel or somebody's telling you about going to the hairdresser or whatever, you might spontaneously make a picture in your head. Or if you're trying to plan your vacation, you might, get pictures in your head. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to figure out what goes in those pictures and where do they go? So what objects do you put? What's the point of view and what's the lighting and all that kind of thing? Because really you're creating a scene in your head. Nobody really has any good idea of how your mind decides unconsciously, usually, what to put in that scene and where to put it.
And also just where did those pictures come from? Do they come from memories? Do they come from, like, I've always wondered in terms of, like, do blind people also put pictures in their head if they have never seen anything?
That's a great question. So certainly there's nowhere else that the pictures could come from except your memories. So basically the question becomes, how do you use your memories to create pictures of new things? Now, people who are blind from birth tend not to have this is getting a little technical, but they tend to not have what we would call visual imagery, but they might have spatial imagery. So they can, a blind person has an idea of where everything is. And in some sense you might think of that as visual information, but it's experienced in terms of sound and touch and those kind of things. But you can have a sense of where things are without having necessarily a picture of it in your head. In fact, some people who are not blind, in fact, two people who worked in my laboratory have what's called aphantasia, which is the inability to have any mental imagery at all. So if I ask you, if I ask most people to how many windows were in the house you grew up in, the way they would answer that is they would simulate in their minds a visual image of walking through the house and counting them. Yeah. But people who have aphantasia can't do that. So, there are ways of getting spatial information that are not visual, but they're still involved with memories.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind a little bit too is in planning things that aren't real yet in terms of 3D spaces. And one of the things that popped into my mind really quickly, my son has autism and couldn't speak till he was 5, basically. He could say a few words, but verbally, very developmentally delayed, but he was super good at creating things out of paper that were 3D representations and still is fantastic at it. So the idea of him being able to plan things in 3D and I guess seeing those things in 3D shapes in his mind and putting them together like very complex Lego sets without looking at the steps, just kind of looking at the final picture and being able to do it. And things like that. Is that the same sort of thing as seeing, like, picturing yourself on vacation at the beach before it happens? Or is that do you think that's a different type of the planning? I'm going to make this Lego car, or imagining yourself in the future?
Well, I would guess that your son tends to make things that he's seen before, right? Like he's either seen, he's like, or does he make up new, does he make up brand new creative, like 3D things?
It's both, but.
Oh, well, that's good. That's interesting. Okay. Because usually with autism, autistic people tend to have a little less meaning making. So they're actually quite good at replicating exactly what they see, which is when you get, I shouldn't say most autistic people, but savants, they can replicate, you know, you've seen the drawings, the amazing drawings they make, like based on one view. And the reason that most of us can't do that is because when we see something, we compress it into what we understand and we lose the details. And in fact, you can make people behave more like autistic savants if you disable a part of their brain. Suddenly they'll be able to render things on a piece of paper with a lot of fidelity. So there's an interesting thing going on. There are parts of the brain that see things exactly the way they are, and then there are parts of the brain that interpret it and have put meanings on it. And most of the time, for normal people, that's what we're using. We're using our meaning. We're not using the literal details.
Yeah.
We remember the gist.
Like, and it's almost more symbolic than it is. Yeah, that's fascinating. And
autistics are better at raw data.
Copying. Right, that makes sense. And then, so you're trying to get computers really to be able to imagine, or maybe you can kind of unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, so we start with the idea that your imagination is based on your perceptual history. So if you're going to imagine a house, you're going to imagine some combination of the houses you've seen in the past, right? Either a particular house you've seen in the past or some averaging or something like that. So if you live in a world where houses look a particular way, you're more likely to imagine a house that way. So I like to give the example of cats. So if I live in Canada and, you know, and I'm an American. So cats, for me and people in my culture, tend to be indoor animals. You don't tend to see a lot of cats outside, right? So if you were to imagine a cat, according to the theory that we're working with, you'd be more likely to imagine a cat in an indoor setting than in an outdoor setting if you were to imagine a scene with a cat. Dogs, on the other hand, unless you own one, are usually seen outside because they're being walked, right? Now, in a place like India, there are a whole lot of stray cats. So most, and they're not as big as pets. So I would predict that, and I don't have any evidence for this yet, but I would predict, according to our theory, that if you were an Indian person asked to imagine a scene with a cat in it, they would imagine a cat like out on the street or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So our challenge is, how do we get a computer? if we're going to replicate human imagination, first of all, how do we get some like data that represents what people see in their lifetime? And to do that, we've gotten databases of photographs that are labeled. So we have we have a database of 50,000 photographs, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually not enough. We need more, but this is what we've got. And they're labeled with what's in the picture and where it is. So if it's a picture of a living room, we know that these pixels are the couch, these pixels are the ceiling, these pixels are a lamp. So when you ask the system to imagine a scene with a bed in it, what it can do is it can look over all the pictures and say, okay, well, what other labels tend to appear in the same picture with a bed? And we're going to put a handful of those in. And then where do they go? And we know from the pictures where they are, so we can say, oh, okay, like a road is usually beneath a car, and we, you know, a person is often standing next to, you know, a tree or something like that. So the computer mines this database of photographs, and we assume that the photographs are like a substitute for human memory. And then we try to recreate visual scenes that that are supposed to be reflective of the way the world really is.
Now, does this have anything to do with, will this play into like virtual reality at all and how scenes can be made in like virtual worlds, you think?
Right. So what I just described to you is our endeavor to recreate two-dimensional, like photograph-like scenes. And our, one of the next steps in the laboratory is to try to do it in three dimensions too. Now, we don't have 3D photographs, but we do have a lot of 3D models made for movies, 3D movies and video games and those kinds of things. So if we can get data about the nature of the 3D of the world in three dimensions, then we can start creating 3D worlds that can be explored with virtual reality or, you know, like a normal video game interface or whatever, a 3D environment that you can actually walk through. So virtual reality is one way to look at a 3D environment that can also be viewed in other ways.
Wow. And so what are some of the other things you're doing in the lab setting?
That's our main focus. We're trying to do, we're trying to replicate human imagination in 2D. We're also, now we're trying to get it to work in three dimensions. We're also doing neural modeling. So there's a an exciting new piece of software out of the University of Waterloo. And that allows you to quite easily do neural simulations on in software. So you can create a bunch of neurons and connect them together in certain ways. And we're trying to replicate what picturing things in your head is like at the brain level in simulated neurons and software, which is very exciting. It's never really been done before.
Wow. Huh. I'm actually having trouble wrapping my brain around that.
Well, okay. A nice way to think about it might be, you might have heard like a physicist, astrophysicist might do a galaxy simulation. So they'll, in a computer, they'll make a simulation of two galaxies colliding and how does the gravity, affect them and how do they fly apart from each other? And then they they compare it to real world data that they've seen in space of galaxies colliding. And by making a computer model, if it matches the way things look in the real world, then it adds credibility to the physics that underlie the model. Similarly, we are trying to recreate human imagination, and if the things that the computer imagines resemble the kinds of things that people imagine when given the same instructions, then, we have replicated, well, it adds support for our underlying theory. Similarly, we're trying to, these physicists aren't taking actual galaxies and throwing them together. That's impossible, right? Similar, they're just doing it in software. Similarly, we are trying to simulate neurons in software and seeing if that lines up with the behavioral and the neuroscience data that scientists collect.
Yeah. Now, have you seen some of the work done in mice that have been genetically altered to have photosensitive neurons, and then they can be turned on or turned off? Have you seen any of this stuff?
I've seen stuff like it, yeah.
Because I was just watching this. What they did was they genetically alter the DNA of these mice, and then they are able to basically take these memories of mice in a certain comforting environment, and basically the neurons are sensitive to light, and so they can capture the picture of the exact neurons that fired during this environment, and they capture a memory of this environment. And then they put these mice in a sort of scary environment where they freeze and they're too scared to move because it's just an environment that's very lit and there's nowhere to hide. And then what they do is they turn on these neural pathways of the memory of this other environment. And because they know the exact neurons to turn on of the other memory, they think they're back in that other environment again.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's neat.
And they are experiencing the same. They're remembering that other environment, and they just go about their business as if they're in that other environment. And it's actually unbelievable. And you're thinking, it's a little bit, okay, we realize these are genetically altered mice, and they can be completely controlled with this flip of the switch, and they switch it off and they switch it on. They go from being terrified to being fine. And obviously there's been a lot of, they've been messed with a lot with their DNA,
right.
But they're completely controlled.
Right.
And it is a little, it's a little Frankensteinish, but the ability to control the neurons so much is kind of the shocker. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what had you write your book about, the book Riveted that you wrote, and then maybe you can talk about some of the key concepts in it. But what was the impetus for the book in the first place?
Well, I've always been an amateur artist in various ways, and drawing and acting and dance and these kinds of things. But then when I started getting trained as a scientist, so when I was like learning theater and all these other things, they have all these rules. They have all these people that are higher in the visual plane are going to be seen as more powerful. In theater, for example, and in art, we have all these different rules. Motion from left to right is more powerful than motion right to left. And, these are artists, and they've learned this stuff through trial and error, and it's sort of folk wisdom. Okay. And when I started getting trained as a scientist, I couldn't help wondering, like, hey, I wonder if these people are actually correct. there are no scientific studies, that I knew of at the time. And so I started thinking how neat it would be to apply the scientific method to the arts. Mm. Anyway, that was sort of an idea that I had in the back of my mind during graduate school, but I was so busy during graduate school, I didn't have time to pursue it. Mm. But after I graduated, I had a little time to do some reading and stuff that interested me. And I found out that particularly in the last 20 years, there's been a great flourishing of scientific work on what makes art work and not work.
Mm.
And some of these things are supported and some of them are not. Some of this folk wisdom is supported and some of it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But I also started looking at the cognitive science of religion, which is also a burgeoning field, about why people believe in religion and what religions tend to be like based on our psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that a lot of the reasons that people like religions are the same reasons that they like art.
Mm, yes.
Like,
nice.
There are good stories, there are things that just are meaningful to people. And so I started having this idea, like, well, maybe we're interested in everything we're interested in. We're interested in for the same underlying psychological reasons.
Mm.
And I thought, wow, maybe I can make a theory that sort of explains why we're interested in anything.
Mm.
And that's what the book Riveted is about. So it's about the psychological foundations of why we find anything interesting. So I try to cover everything from sports to religion to newscasts to urban legends to horoscopes and all the arts. So that's what the book's about.
Mm-hmm.
And the underlying theory, I don't want to give away too much because I do know from my research in the book that people lose interest if they feel they know everything.
Right. we want to tease and salt people.
Yeah,
that's
exactly,
good.
People,
right.
That's actually why certain films like Prometheus or the ending of the Sopranos TV series, people can't stop talking about because it is ambiguous and they don't know and their mind won't let it go.
Okay.
But once your mind feels like it understands it, it sort of wraps it up, puts it away, and allows you to forget it to move on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that being said, some of the things that are common to arts and religion are like stories about people.
Mm-hmm.
Most religion is about people, either supernatural people or real people, but there are no religious theories about the weak electromagnetic force, or, even like the cosmological theories of religion all have to do with people or at least human-like personalities, right? So it's always relevant to people in some way or other.
Right.
Similarly, if you look at the arts, it's just absolutely replete with people. I actually conducted a study of paintings and found that the number of paintings with people in it vastly outnumbers the ones that don't. Now, it's not a newsflash or anything, but it is interesting that, we are more interested in people than any other animal. For sure.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also more interested in things with people and animals than anything else.
Mm.
And basically, if you look at religion as a something that undergoes evolution, because new religions are being created every day, there are about 4,000 religions active right now, and there have been many, many more in history, a religion that doesn't cater to our underlying psychological proclivities just won't survive.
Mm.
And it has to match what's going on in our heads.
Now, would you classify religion, because these are can be slippery words, like would you classify religion as the same as spirituality, or you feel that there's some overlap? Because
there's some overlap, but people tend to mean different things
right.
by spirituality and religion. But generally, religion tends to be defined by anthropologists as a group. A belief that is shared with some social group that involves supernatural entities.
Right, right.
Like agents. So, if there's no gods or spirits. So if you believe in spirituality, that we're kind of all connected nebulously, that probably doesn't count as a religion.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe in ghosts or embodied, or not embodied spirits, but spirits that have their own desires and beliefs, and motivations, then it is getting closer to religion. But unless it's sort of a shared thing
with rituals
and a
history,
really,
right? Okay,
yeah.
And because I was thinking that people who would consider themselves, well, especially in North America, there's a lot of people who don't consider themselves religious, but they certainly consider themselves spiritual and part of something. That there's something bigger going on out there, and they do maybe feel one with something else, or it's not quite like they're going to go to a temple.
That feeling one with the universe, kind of thing,
right?
It's sort of a genetic thing, actually.
Okay, good. Tell me more.
That's determined by your genes, actually. So the way it seems to work, from my understanding, is that people who have this feeling of connectedness and the feeling of part of something greater in the universe that they can't really perceive directly, mm-hmm. tend to end up being more religious.
Mm.
So that's the relationship. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, slightly depends on the culture. So if you've got somebody who feels a very strong connection with, you know, sort of being one with everything, and they're born in a very religious society, they're going to be very religious with whatever religion they're born in. Born into a more secular social group, like the intelligentsia in America and Canada, for example, they might call themselves a spiritual atheist or whatever. But that's where culture and, you know, your genetic proclivities interact.
Well, that's okay. So if somebody now, does that have a social component? Like somebody feels one with the universe, would this be also a personality thing where they feel like they're a more social person in their temperament, or is that something else?
Are you asking if your tendency to feel one with the universe is correlated with your sociability?
Right, and in a temperament psychological sense.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah. It's really interesting what you're saying, because humans, well, obviously there's a lot of animals out there that are social creatures, but humans have some really unique things, like making art or wanting to make the world a better place, or religion or things like that are so different than animals that we keep trying to dig into it, you know. We keep trying to say what's going on here, and that's what makes searching so interesting, and the science of the brain and what's going on so interesting.
I agree.
Which is kind of why you're doing it, right?
That's why I'm doing it. I mean, I love my job, and I think it's just, I just love it. Fascinating.
Yeah. So what were some of the things that surprised you as you were researching for your book, and that you came across that you thought, well, that was a surprise, that you thought, I didn't think it was going to be like
that? I have always been an atheist, and as an atheist, now I realize that my atheism is mostly genetic, which is kind of interesting. That I didn't know. I didn't know that like 60% of your what's called religiosity is actually genetically determined. So, people who are religious or are not religious are mostly that way because of their genes. And it's not because of any decision they made or anything like that. But anyway, not really understanding religion, not really getting it. Like, it just seemed very silly to me. Mm-hmm. I had this idea that it was, and I saw that, you know, I tend to focus on the bad aspects of it, the things mm-hmm. that, the ways that it made the world worse in my mind.
Mm.
In reading a lot about religion and the cognitive science of religion and the theories about why it even exists, I've come to have a more moderate view of it, I guess, more tempered mm-hmm. There's a very interesting theory that I think has some truth to it, has mm-hmm. got some evidence backing it up, that says that religion is basically something that evolved in humanity to help groups survive and compete with other groups.
Oh.
So basically, groups that have religion tend to out-compete groups that don't. Because the idea is that you've got usually religions are tied up with some kind of moral code
mm-hmm.
That keeps you from cheating your neighbors, basically.
Mm.
And if you look at religious people who are religious, or even non-religious people who are what we say primed with religious imagery.
Mm.
So like people who are not even religious, but you like talk about God or something,
mm-hmm.
they will tend to act more what we call pro-socially to people in their in-group, but not in their out-group. So it looks like religion had a function in helping keep societies together.
Yeah, right.
Which makes me sort of sit back and reflect on, well, okay, you know, removing religion from the world without replacing it with something else that will keep people behaving nicely to each other is perhaps a scary prospect.
Mm.
You know, there's an interesting study of kibbutzim in Israel mm-hmm. where people, kibbutz is like a commune, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there were a whole lot of kibbutzim, that's the plural.
Mm-hmm.
Some were religious and some were secular.
Mm.
And, they started studying these things. And after, I don't know, 20 years or whatever, none of the secular ones survived.
Oh, wow.
Like, it seems like, and that is one bit of evidence for this theory that religion helps keep groups together, right? Because when times get tough and this and that, this shared religion and the belief that, you know, you got to be good to your immediate neighbors actually was the thing that determined whether or not the kibbutz made it or not.
It's like a deeper identity beyond the circumstances of whatever bad is happening.
Yeah,
in
like even if you're really hungry, you're right. still not going to take more food than your share. Well, you're less likely to take more food than your own fair share from your neighbors if you are religious. That's what it appears. That's what the data seem to show.
Well, that seems to make sense. I was also wondering, you know, there's a lot of studies now about meditation and prayer and how it changes the brain and shrinks the amygdala and things like that. And just, you know, people who are praying or meditating, you know, whether it's in Eastern religions or Western ones or whatever, just throughout human history, that they might also be potentially primed for doing better, that that religious groups or whatever might be outlasting non-religious ones just because for similar reasons, but that their brains might actually be a little bit different as well to make them be able to cope under stress.
Well, certainly people who meditate in any way, whether it's prayer or some mm-hmm. secular meditation,
right.
have, you know, it does change your brain mm-hmm. And can make you less stressed and blah, blah, blah. I've never heard of a study that shows that that kind of thing makes you a better person, but it could be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure there'll be probably a lot more studying on what exactly happens now that we have more brain imaging going on. But what can you tell me about why jokes make us laugh?
So the best theory of laughter that I know of is basically that laughter is a social signal to indicate that what appears to be dangerous actually isn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, that might sound a little strange because when most of us think about laughter, we think about jokes or humor that's explicitly designed to make us laugh. Mm-hmm. But if you study laughter in the wild, so to speak, most laughter happens in conditions that have nothing funny about them whatsoever.
Oh.
So, like, you see a friend that you didn't expect to see,
mm-hmm.
People will laugh. They'll say, oh, how are you? Ha, ha, ha. They'll laugh. And we don't even remember it as laughing. But you know, when people laugh when they are on roller coasters.
Mm.
I knew a friend who was mugged, and after the mugger left, he and his friend looked at each other, and they both burst out laughing. Now, what's going on here is that you've got, like, something that is, like, unexpected, shocking, but ultimately you feel that it's safe. You laugh, and it's sort of a communication tool to everybody that, oh, it's actually okay.
Oh,
now, so this is why people laugh when people slip and fall. Nobody laughs if someone slips and falls and breaks a leg. People laugh when they slip and fall and everything's fine, you know. So jokes, the way jokes work is that they always set up some expectation that, and then the punchline thwarts that expectation in a way that is shocking, unusual, and then causes a laugh response to it. And one of the ways they tested this unexpectedness theory, and this is getting a little farther from danger, right? It's just like things that are unexpected. But one of the ways they tested it was they had people in the lab just watching like a ball on a screen go across the screen again and again and again. And then suddenly the ball stopped in the middle of the screen and people laughed. Now there's nothing funny about a ball stopping in the middle of the screen.
Oh, right.
But people laugh just because it's not expected. And they've done other things where they have people lift weights, then the third weight is actually really light, and they laugh.
Oh.
So basically jokes make us laugh because of thwarted expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's also the laughter at, like, inappropriate stuff, too. Like the sexist joke, and some people laugh, some people don't laugh, you know, it's a different kind of, like, laughter. Like there's some jokes that are, there's some things that are the unexpected surprise, but then there's some jokes that are like, I shouldn't be laughing at this, but I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Which so what's going on there is you've got, different parts of your brain are reacting to it in different ways. So there's a part of your brain that can find a sexist or racist joke funny because of the unexpectedness of it, where it doesn't even really matter what the underprivileged group is. I remember, like, when I was young, people would tell jokes about what we said, Pollocks, right? There would be, you know, and I hear some of those same jokes in Canada about people from Newfoundland. It doesn't even matter. Like, you know, different cultures have their own, like, oh, what group is not so smart, right? And then they make jokes about that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got these other parts of your mind that is sensitive to, you know, cultural sensitivity and not being prejudiced and blah, blah, blah. And so you can have, you know, it's very normal to have multiple reactions to a stimulus like that.
Yeah. And then the movies make us cry part. What does that entail?
Yeah. So anyway, just the thing about the title, we had a devil of a time trying to find a good title because the book about
it's a good title.
So much. I mean, there's actually only about 3 pages of the book are about jokes, but it's like,
oh, okay.
So, you know, but it's hard to get what the whole book is about in the title. But basically, we react to media the way we do emotionally because a large part of our brain doesn't really realize it's fiction. So when you look at when you're going to a movie, let's say you go to a movie at a movie theater, what you're actually looking at is light on a screen, right? Like we all sort of know that, but you can't look at the movie and just see it as light on a screen. You see people, you hear words, you see faces, you recognize, you can't help but respond to those images as though they were real people. And that is really going on at a very deep level in your brain. A large portion of your brain doesn't react the same way whether you're actually looking at it or whether you're looking at a representation of it. So the reason you get sad, like I talk in the book about Finding Nemo, which a lot of people have seen, so it's a great example. But you know, I was like in tears within 5 minutes of watching this movie. Now, think about how ridiculous it is in some sense, right? I'm not looking at real people getting hurt.
Right.
I'm not looking at someone right in front of me getting hurt. Okay. I'm watching a movie of getting hurt. Not only is it a movie, but it's not even a movie about people.
Right.
It's a movie about fish. But not only, it's not even real fish. It's computer-generated fish. So I'm actually crying about a story about fictitious fish that are computer-generated.
That have people voices.
They're recordings of people's voices. They're not even actual people's voices. But in our modern world, we are exposed to so much representation in the media that we forget that you're not actually looking at a person on TV. It's actually just a recording or a broadcast or something like that. But most of our minds don't know that. So we end up like getting carried away with stories and these kinds of things because a lot of our minds don't even know that it's fiction, which is why you have to tell yourself that it's only a movie when you're watching a scary movie. But it only helps a little bit.
Ah. Well, do you think that part of your brain just latches onto that something of it is true for you and that it just hits you at some other level that feels true to something in your life or in your past?
Yes. I think that's also going on. But, you know, you can be affected by things that are very hard to relate to as well, you know. I mean, I know that some things that I thought were stupid and I don't know why anybody cared when I was, you know, 15 years old, now I watch it and I find them very deep and you know, full of pathos because I've had more life experience and I can relate to it better, you know.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, there's some of that going on for sure.
Yeah, and you can be, I don't know, I've seen certain movies and, you know, I'm sitting next to somebody, it doesn't affect them at all. And I'm sitting right next to them and it's really affecting me. And then I'm thinking, well, is it just a time of my life where I'm more vulnerable and more emotionally vulnerable and stuff is getting in that would, you know, in 2 months not affect me the same way.
And that's
what's so interesting about the brain. When I've been suffering this fall from extreme migraines and I've been really thinking a lot about the brain because now I'm taking this medicine to every day to prevent them. And I've noticed differences in how I think because I'm on this medication and trying to adjust to it and knowing that it's changing my brain chemistry, which is really, really fascinating. And you're realizing, wow, you know, this is how I'm perceiving the world. And now I'm perceiving it slightly differently because of these, you know, these migraines that will like make me go blind for a period of time and things like that and really affect my, you know, my neural capabilities. And so it's made me think a lot about how we perceive the world and how neural function works and things like that. And I went through a period of time where I was crying a lot. It was right after this very big migraine. And I was crying a lot And it was probably directly either related to the medication I had or to the migraine I had. And it was just really a strange little kind of after effect that was helped by medicine. But it was like, you know, you go from 1 minute feeling a certain way and then knowing that it's something in your brain that's doing that.
And, oh, yeah. And I feel, you know? I mean, I feel that with something much less extreme than the medication. And my wife keeps little cans of mini Cokes around, and she says for medicinal reasons. Because, you know, if I get cranky or whatever, it's either, you know, I need a little bit of blood sugar or caffeine or something like that. And she gives me a Coke and suddenly I'm laughing and happy. So, yeah, it is kind of humbling to see how just like a spoonful of peanut butter can like make the difference between me being seeing the world as really grumpy, or, you know, versus happy and wonderful.
The blood sugar takes a hit, you know. And yeah, we're all these machines that need a tune-up once in a while. And and it is amazing how much you can be affected by a little tweak here, a little tweak there. And here we are perceiving the world with these same, you know, this organ that if it's compromised, then you can't be an advocate very well for yourself because, you know, that's the thing you need to be able to reason the world.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah. So, well, I guess we could probably wrap it up. Where was the best place that people can reach you to find out more about your work or see? You've done 3 TEDx talks, and people can look those up as well. And maybe you can talk about a little bit about what each one of them was, because we didn't mention them.
Sure, sure. So if you search for Jim Davies TEDx on YouTube, you can see the various videos I put up there. But I've given 2 TED talks on imagination, one on the kind of stuff we talked about today, how computers can replicate it. Another one on how we make mistakes when we imagine our future and how that can get in the way of our happiness and that kind of thing. And I also gave a talk on my theory of education, which is about how you should give students assignments that help the world in some way. So that might be of interest. I also recommend my book if people are interested in reading about why you're interested in things. Some people find it kind of, they look at everything differently after they read it. So they can check that out. And you can see my website at jimdavies.org. And I also publish a lot in the online science magazine Nautilus.
Yeah, that is where I found you first, and then I went over to watch the TED Talk. So I've been reading Nautilus a lot more. The great thing about the TED Talk that I saw, which was about imagining the future, was the planning bias point that you made, which was that we don't ever plan. Maybe you could just quickly explain that, because it's just such a clever point about planning.
we basically underestimate plan completion times, or task completion times. So people don't, when they imagine how long it's going to take to do something, they never imagine the random crap that comes up and gets in the way. So they think, oh, that should only take me 5 hours. And, you know, if you wait till the last minute and you wait till 5 hours before, inevitably something that was absolutely unpredictable. The only thing predictable about it was that something would happen. But you never know what will come up and delay that. And since people never seem to learn to get better at this, we're constantly overbooking ourselves because we underestimate task completion times in the future.
Yeah. It was the whole idea of, like, I'm not doing anything in a year from now. I love that point. It was like, oh, yeah, I can meet.
My
schedule's
totally open.
No,
it's amazing. Like, it's amazing how I'm busy now, but in a year from now, I'll be doing nothing.
I know.
It's so stupid when you say it out loud, but we do it every day.
I know. And I thought to myself, I know I've thought that. I know for sure. If somebody had just asked me that a minute ago, I would have said the exact thing. And now I can't ever say that again because I know better.
Well, good, good. That's what I hope my work does. It helps people make better decisions about their lives.
This was really fun, Jim. Thank you so much for coming on the show and enlightening us.
That was a lot of fun.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.